Welcome to another session of Tanya 200. We're up to chapter 30, but before we begin with chapter 30, let's go back and complete some of the thoughts that we find in chapter 29. In chapter 29, the Rebbe is talking about smugness and its cure. Complacency, which is called timtum halev, a lifeless heart, in that the person cannot inspire himself to the next level because of complacency. The solution is to become brokenhearted. And by being brokenhearted, the person is shattering the complacency of his animal soul. And here, the Rebbe says that there are two kinds of people. There are the righteous and saintly people who identify strictly with their godly soul. They are about godliness. That's their reality. Their body, their personality, their individuality is just a detail. But their identity, their essence, is godliness. God's will, God's purpose, God's commandments. For them to be brokenhearted would mean that they have lost their godliness. But for the non-tzaddik, for the non-saint, the identity they have of themselves is their animal soul. They identify with their individuality, with who they are as a created being, as an individual. So when they become brokenhearted, when they are disgusted with themselves, the self that they are disgusted with is the animal self. And the godly soul is to them an addition to who they are. Even though in truth, the godly soul is our true identity. And that's why deep down inside, everyone truly wants to do what God created them to do, because the godly soul is our true identity. So what do I really want? And who is this I? In truth, the I is the godly soul. And that's why the Alter Rebbe said, in a definition of what is a Jew, what does it mean to be born Jewish? It means that you don't want to be, nor can you be, alienated from God. That's our true selves. That's who we really are. But that's not always the way we experience ourselves or perceive ourselves. So on a daily functional level, we identify with our animal soul rather than our godly soul. And so when I become brokenhearted, what's broken is not the true me, but the ungodliness of the animal soul. And so by splintering the smugness or the complacency of the animal soul, I'm not destroying myself, but releasing the true self that wants to continue to grow and is not content and is not complacent with the achievements of the past. Another thing in chapter 29 is that this experience where the godly soul deflates the animal soul and sees the lack of truth and the lack of reality that unholiness has or doesn't have. When the unholiness disappears because the godly soul called it names and described it correctly as wicked and disgusting and despicable and so on, unholiness is like darkness, because darkness doesn't have an existence of its own. It is merely the absence of light. So when you bring in the godliness, the unholiness disappears like darkness disappears when you turn on the light. Which means that the truth about ourselves is our godliness and not our unholiness. the Rebbe uses an event in the Torah to illustrate this. There was that time when Moses sent spies into Israel from the desert, and they came back and gave a very negative report. And this was considered sinful because God had told them that the plan was that they would go into the land of Israel and they would inherit it. It was the promised land. And the spies came back and said, no, we can't go. We can't go because the people there are much too strong, the cities are much too strong, fortified to the heavens, and even God couldn't possibly do this. A while later, they had a change of heart, and they came to Moses and said, okay, we'll go. And Moses said, no, now it's too late. And so they wandered for 40 years in the desert until that entire generation died out, and the children born in the desert were the ones who entered the promised land under Joshua. The question is, when they came and said, we don't believe that this is possible, they meant that even God couldn't give us the land. What happened that made them have a change of heart when they came back and said, okay, we're ready to go? In between those two events, we don't find anywhere that they sat down to study or that Moses gave them a lecture on God's strength and God's abilities and that would cause them to suddenly believe what they hadn't believed before. Instead, we find where God got really angry and called them names, said, this is a wicked congregation, I've had it with them, they're going to die here in the desert. And Moses came and repeated it to the Jews. And when they heard this, they said, okay, we'll go. Now the question is, if they didn't believe in God's ability to give them the land, calling them names wouldn't make any difference. In fact, God said, you will all die here in the desert because you refused to go. And they said, okay, so we'll go. What was this? What brought this change of heart? And the Rebbe says that we see from this that there was no need for a change of heart. In truth, they believed in what God wanted for them. They believed that they were meant to go, and they were really ready to go, willing to go. Only some kind of interference was created by their animal soul, and they started arguing arguments that they themselves did not really believe. So when they said, God can't do this, it wasn't them talking. It was some other reality interfering with who they really were. And so when Moses said, you know, this is crazy, you're getting on God's nerves, they said, okay, fine. They sobered up and they were ready to go. Not because they had gained any kind of faith, but because they simply were acting on their natural faith, which was being blocked or distorted or something for the moment. And from this we can all learn that if we start having thoughts of doubts about the reality and the truth of godliness and Torah and holiness, this is not the truth of ourselves. We have a godly soul, and the godly soul is our true identity. That's what we really are, and the godly soul has no doubts, and the godly soul has no distractions, and the godly soul has no other god that competes with the God of the Torah. And so all we need to do is simply sober up and raise our voice against this darkness that has no substance and has no reality, and then we see it fall away. We see it dissolve. So people who are having problems with all sorts of distractions, with all sorts of weaknesses, with all sorts of needs and dependencies, they're all untrue. They're not who we really are. And all we need to do is get in touch with who we really are, and they all fall away without any further argument and without any further treatment or waste of energy. Once we touch the truth within ourselves obviously the light goes on and the darkness just disappears. Chapter 30. In addition to all of the humbling and sobering thoughts mentioned in chapter 29, and those are that the very fact that we desire what God despises makes us very far from God, the fact that we sinned in the past as children, in our childhood, all of those sins, although we're not held responsible for them, but the ill effects, the ungodliness that accumulated is further distancing us from God. Then there are all the activities, the neutral, normal, innocent activities of eating, sleeping, drink, everything we do that isn't for a godly purpose, all feeds the natural soul or the animal soul at the expense of the godly soul. And then finally, even during our sleep, even while we're sleeping, the unholiness continues to accumulate in the dreams that we're having and so on. So all of this makes us very far from God, and we get very angry at this unholy thing that is keeping us from being who we really are. And this splinters or shatters the complacency of the animal soul and releases new energy with which to serve God. But there's more. And this moves us more into the positive rather than the negative. Chapter 30, the Rebbe says that we also need to practice humility. Humility as it's described in the Torah, where we are told that we should feel inferior in the presence of every person. We should feel inferior to every other human being. And how is this possible? How can this be honest? It's by taking into account the circumstances and the conditions in which others find themselves. So when we're in the presence of another human being, there are only a few possibilities. One is that the other person is much better than we are, more godly, more holy, more moral, and so obviously we should feel humble. The other possibility is that the other person is much worse than us, less moral, less holy, less godly, less observant. And yet we're supposed to feel inferior to that person as well. How does that work? By taking into consideration the other person's circumstances. So we can feel inferior even in the presence of the lowest of the low. And that's by considering what it is we expect of the lowest of the low, and why it is we condemn him and hold him responsible for being the lowest of the low. For example, a person may be a sinful person, but the circumstances of his life contribute to that sinfulness. The person spends all his time trying to make a living, just trying to survive. He spends all his time in a very unwholesome environment, out on the street corners, where he's exposed to all sorts of unholy things. And all of this unholy stuff has an effect after a while. And so he's the lowest of the low. And yet we hold him responsible. And we condemn him for being the lowest of the low, because we expect his devotion to God or his fear of God to help him overcome all that temptation and all that negative exposure to all sorts of unholy stuff. It should all be overcome by his goodness and by his devotion to God. What would it take for a person to have that kind of devotion or that kind of fear of God that it could counteract, outweigh constant daily exposure to all sorts of unholy influences? What kind of a struggle would be necessary? What kind of strength of character would be necessary for the lowest of the low not to sin, considering his circumstances? It's also possible that by nature, this person is a very passionate person, and therefore finds it extremely hard to resist temptation. Whereas other people may by nature be more dispassionate. And therefore, even if he were exposed to unholy things, he is by nature disinterested. And so it's not as difficult for him to ignore and to resist the thing that he's exposed to. So the person has to take into account not how much good does the other person do versus the amount of good that I do. Because that is not an indication of personal value or of personal virtue. It could be that you're blessed, you're fortunate, you're lucked out in that you don't have to be exposed to all those unholy things in order to make a living. Or even if you are exposed, you weren't given that kind of passionate, aggressive nature. So what really counts is how much effort did you invest in your relationship with God compared to the effort that this person is investing just to stay afloat. Or the amount of energy that he would have to invest if he were not to sin, and yet you condemn him for not making that kind of an investment. So we ask ourselves, did I make that kind of investment? Have I put out that kind of effort and that kind of energy in those areas where I need to struggle in order to serve God? So here one person is struggling and fails in his struggles and commits adultery. And we condemn him. We call him the lowest of the low, because we hold him responsible. We say, you should have resisted the temptation. You should have overcome the temptation. And we feel very superior because we haven't committed adultery. We would never commit adultery. But then again, that's not our temptation. That's not our weakness. That's not where we need to struggle. So we demand that the lowest of the low struggle with that which gives him the hardest time. He should overcome his weakest impulses and not sin in spite of all of the exposure. We may not have a problem with adultery, but every person has his challenge. Perhaps we're challenged in some other area, and in our area, there where we have a weakness, that's where we would have to struggle with the same intensity and with the same amount of energy as the lowest of the low would need to struggle not to commit adultery. So to have a fair and honest comparison and evaluation, we can't look at what sin he committed versus what sin we commit. We have to look at the willingness to serve, the willingness to go the extra mile in order to serve God properly. And so if we find that we don't put out the kind of energy in serving God that we expect of the lowest of the low, then we are no better than the lowest of the low. We're only luckier, more fortunate, but not more virtuous. This still doesn't tell us why we should feel inferior. It only says that we can't judge behavior, we have to judge effort. And if we don't put out that kind of effort, then we're no better. But no better makes us equal, not inferior. So how do we feel humble in the presence of every person, even the lowest of the low? And for this, the Rebbe says, the lowest of the low lives in an unholy environment. His life is not about the study of Torah and the service of God. And yet he struggles and he tries and often fails. But the person who is judging is a person who has studied more, who has more information, who has been exposed to better things, finer things. And if after all of that, the advantaged person, doesn't put out the effort necessary to serve God properly that he would expect of the lowest of the low, and condemns the lowest of the low for not putting out that kind of energy, then they're not equal. The lowest of the low at least has some justification for being what he is. He is disadvantaged. He hasn't learned, he wasn't taught, he wasn't exposed to good things, he's not aware, he doesn't understand. But the person who's judging has learned, and he is closer, more informed, more knowledgeable in godliness and in Torah. And even so, he doesn't put out the effort that he expects of the lowest of the low, and that makes him worse. Worse than the lowest of the low. Because for the lowest of the low, even their intentional sins are considered unintentional because of their ignorance. So with an ignorant person, even the sins that they commit purposely, it's considered as if they were doing it out of ignorance and therefore unintentional. And the opposite is true of the learned person. If a person who has studied commits a sin unintentionally, it's almost as if he committed it intentionally, because he is held to a higher standard. And if he fails, the failure is greater than the failure of the lowest of the low. And so the struggle that even a noble person will on occasion need to make in order to serve God properly is in those areas where the goodness is subtle and easy to overlook. So for example, when a person doesn't concentrate properly or doesn't invest the right type of energy or amount of energy in his prayers, When praying, when davening, we're supposed to bare our soul and be completely and totally honest with God. That takes a lot of energy. We can be partially honest, we can be almost honest, but to be completely honest takes a great amount of energy, even for a person who is who lives in the world of study and in the world of godliness and holiness. To be able to do this daily, to really face God honestly, without any shtick and without any defenses, is a very challenging and very difficult thing to do. And if we fail to do it because we just don't want to invest that kind of energy, then we are no better than the people we condemn because we expect them to make a heroic effort not to sin, or, for example, not to commit adultery. Another area in which even the finest person may have to struggle is to break their habits in the performance of a mitzvah. For example, you get comfortable giving a certain amount of charity. It becomes your habit. You give a tenth of your earnings, you give more than a tenth, but it becomes a habit. Now you want to break that habit and give more than you're accustomed to giving. That's going to take a struggle. To do that, you really have to invest a lot of energy to get yourself into a new habit to give a significantly greater amount of charity. A little bit more is not a great struggle. The same is true with study. You can study a certain number of hours a day, and it becomes your habit. It becomes comfortable and easy. If you want to study a lot more than that, it would take a great struggle. And then, in avoiding evil, in not sinning, we also find certain areas where there's a great struggle. And that is, for example, in speech, not to say things that may reflect badly on other people, even though it's true, even though it's not malicious, even though it is a slight insult or a slight embarrassment. To avoid that takes a great amount of attention, a great amount of awareness. And that's a struggle, because this is a constant, ongoing thing. We're always talking, and we're always talking about people, about someone, about something that could reflect badly. And so the Rebbe quotes a story from the Talmud. The author of the Mishnah, Rebbe Yehuda, came home one day and found some writings on Jewish law. He read it and assumed that his son had written it. So when his son came home, he said to his son, "What you wrote here isn't exactly correct in terms of Jewish law." And his son said, "I didn't write that. Yehuda the tailor wrote it." And his father said to him, "Beware of Lashon Hara. Beware of slighting another person." Now here what we have is a very slight insult. The fact that Yehuda the tailor could have been mistaken in his commentary on Jewish law is not a great insult. After all, he's a tailor, not a scholar. His son said, "I didn't write it, Yehuda the tailor wrote it." He wasn't saying it to put down the tailor, he was saying it to clear himself. And even so, his father said to him, "Be careful. Avoid Lashon Hara."